thank you ever so much, Peter. It's a great privilege to be introduced by you and to be in the colloquium for a third time running. So this is my triptych complete now. The first one was on game theory. The second one was on experimental economics. Today I'm going to stray from both game theory and experimental economics into one of the world's great natural experiments with a common currency. The creation of the euro led to a very curious situation I shall submit to you. The continent that was up until then uniting, despite of, and possibly because of, many different languages and cultures, seems to be torn apart these days by a common currency. A delicious contradiction, just like the modest proposal is a contradiction in terms. As always in this colloquium, our task as teachers is not so much to present fully-fledged papers, but to speak to the anxieties of PhD students and to find a way of relating our own anxieties during periods of research and imparting some of the techniques and manners in which we deal with this anxiety in the process of completing some work. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about the book that Peter so graciously referred to, which has a title that is quite controversial in itself. It's not European Union, it's Europe Unhinged. And the subtitle tells, I think, quite a story. Okay, now to my theme. Why is Europe not coming together in response to the euro crisis? The question in itself contains two hypotheses. First, that the euro crisis is continuing and shows no signs of abating. Secondly, that Europe is not coming together. Both these hypotheses are hotly contested. The official line in Brussels, for instance, is that the euro crisis is over and now we're simply mopping up after it. Also, the official line is that Europe is coming together, that the European Parliament has acquired new powers recently, that the banking union is a reaction to the euro crisis and is bringing together the banking sectors. And even there is a political debate now at the highest echelons of the European Union on so-called political union. The first hypothesis I'm not going to defend today, that the euro crisis is continuing. This could be the topic of another talk in itself. I shall take it for granted for the purposes of getting on with today's story. On the second hypothesis, I have quite a lot to say, and as you shall see. The part of the new book that I shall be discussing with you today concerns a hypothesis that I'm developing in a couple of chapters as to why, if I'm right that Europe is not coming together, Europe is not coming together, of why it's extremely serious current crisis, which is both political and economic, is failing to lead to a continental type of consolidation in the same way that with every crisis of the 19th century and first part at least, or two-thirds of the 20th century, American economic crisis led to closer union in the United States. Possibly you can think of it even at, you know, even the Great Society could be part of this pattern. Now, let me begin by taking you to a particular date that I think Peter might enjoy. It's the 22nd of November of 1990. Mrs. Thatcher has just been forced out of 10 Downing Street by her own cabinet, by Tory grandees. The main point of contention, if you remember, those of you who were around or who have read about that, was Europe. And Thatcher's reluctance, or actually recalcitrance, regarding monetary union. The majority of her cabinet wanted Britain to be part of that monetary union, and she didn't. Witnesses in that cabinet meeting tell us that the young lady shed a couple of tears, that it was the very first time that she was seen to show emotion and to lose her composure momentarily. Of course, an hour or so ago, Thatcher being Thatcher, by the time she was in the car going to the House of Commons, where she had a scheduled speech to give on Europe, she had regained her composure. Neil Kinnock, the leader of the opposition in that period, was about to ask her pressing questions about her position on Europe, hoping to create, to drive a wedge between herself and the minister that had just gotten rid of her. Mrs. Thatcher had other ideas about whether she would be allow him to drive this wedge.
What sort of vision do they have, Mr. Speaker? None, according to the Right Honourable Gentleman. They want a Europe of subsidies, a Europe of socialist restrictions, a Europe of protectionism. They want it because that's how they would like to run, or is it to ruin, this country? Yeah. Every time we've stood up and fought for Britain and British interests, the front bench opposite have carped and criticised and moaned. Yeah. And on the central issues of Europe's future, they will not tell us where they stand. Do they want a single currency? The Right Honourable Gentleman doesn't even know what it means or the consequences.
Now, this was, of course, her way of reminding her own side, her own Tory side, that she was still the only one of them capable of wiping the floor clean with the leader of the opposition. But then came a question from the opposition benches that you will hear in a minute. One MP asked her, would she still fight against the common currency and an independent central bank as a private member in the House now that she wasn't going to be prime minister anymore? And he felt that by stressing her fight and her struggle against the idea of an independent central bank, he was putting her in a tight spot, that it would be difficult for her to defend that recalcitrance. Of course, Mrs. Thatcher had different ideas about this.
Grateful to the Prime Minister. Would you tell us whether she intends to continue her own personal fight against the single currency and an independent central bank when she leaves office?
No, she's going to be the governor.
On the present structure, accountable to no one, least of all to national parliaments. Because the point of that kind of European Central Bank is no democracy, taking powers away from every single parliament and being able to have a single currency and a monetary policy and an interest rate which takes all political power away from us. As my right honourable friend said in his first speech after the proposal of a single currency is about the politics of Europe, it is about a federal Europe by the back door. So I'll consider the honourable gentleman's proposal. Now, where were we? I'm enjoying this.
We're enjoying this too, I think. Yes. Now, there are two hypotheses in the last few lines by Mrs. Thatcher. Each one of them, by the way, I think, a potential PhD. The first one is that the euro was all about the politics of Europe. And the second one was that it was an attempt to usher in federation through the back door, a kind of Trojan horse. I've labored long and hard personally with these two hypotheses. Let me state it for the record that I am wholeheartedly in agreement with the first one, and I think history has spoken out against the second one. The first hypothesis, that money matters and monetary policy is political, of course, was not a Thatcherite fixation. It was a fixation by Brussels and by perhaps Jacques Delors that it was not a political matter, it was a technical problem, how to bind European economies together monetarily, that had to be dealt with in a technocratic manner. But this was not a widely shared view. Willem Nolling, a member of the board of the Bundesbank, we should be under no illusion that the present controversy over the new European monetary order is about power, influence, and the pursuit of national interests. In other words, highly political. Interestingly, Mrs. Thatcher's greatest foe during that time, outside of Britain and the Tory party, that is, a centre gentleman that you see here, Jacques Delors, a very significant player at the time, who left an indelible mark on the European Union and on the formation of the euro. He was the head of the committee that designed the euro and pushed it through the various layers of European Union decision-making very, very successfully. Jacques Delors was a red flag for Mrs. Thatcher, as he was and still remains in the imaginary of Eurosceptics throughout Europe. Now, there was a very interesting meeting that happened in 1993. I believe it was December 93. Jacques Delors had been the finance minister of President Mitterrand in the early 80s. He presided over a period of tumult, a period that when he realized that his capacity to introduce the kind of macroeconomic policies that he favored was severely circumscribed at the level of French national politics, and there was a kind of project between him and Mitterrand that this kind of policy could only be implemented at the level of the European Union. And this is why he shifted, with the help of President Mitterrand, who was the second person in the room in December of 1993, in this very interesting meeting that I'm going to relate to you. What had happened was this. The Maastricht Treaty, which was effectively the birth certificate of the euro, had already been completed. There had been agreement between France and Germany. The whole thing was in train to what ended up being the European Monetary Union. But Jacques Delors had focused on a missing link in the euro design. And the missing link, as far as he was concerned, was union bonds. This is what he called them. We refer to them these days as Eurobonds. If you want, this is a Hamiltonian view of public debt as the cement of a federation, the cement of a monetary union. In exactly the same way that Hamilton referred to a common debt as a prerequisite for nation building, Delors had the view, it was more technocratic than political and wasn't operating so much at the level of the imaginary, but it was operating at the level of public finance. And the idea that there has to be a degree of commonality of debt with which to solidify and stabilize the monetary union that was being created. The third person in the room was this gentleman here, Stuart Holland, who was Jacques Delors' aide, who scripted a white paper proposing union bonds as a pillar with which to stabilize the monetary union that was being designed at the time. The white paper that Stuart Holland primarily authored was a point of contention within the French government. And Delors' objective in this meeting, imagine, just a meeting of these three men in some office, very nondescript office in Brussels. Delors was very keen to impress upon Mitterrand the importance of this white paper and why it should be implemented. He spoke for 40 minutes, with Mitterrand paying attention and listening faithfully. After the 40 minutes, Mitterrand was staring at the ceiling for 10 nail-biting minutes. 10 minutes of having the President of France staring at the ceiling, making up his mind about your paper is even worse than a PhD thesis defense. I can assure you of that. Now, what is interesting is the response he gave. His response was, Jacques, you're absolutely right. This monetary union would not be stable without the union bonds that you're proposing and the particular forms of public investment that would be funded by these union bonds. But we're not going to do it because Helmut and I do not have the political arithmetic which is necessary in order to carry it through. But I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go on with the monetary union. We'll bind our disparate economies monetarily together. And this is important. Pay attention to this. When in 10 or 15 years' time a major financial crisis hits, our successors will have a choice between introducing that white paper of yours or something of that sort and letting the union fragment. Now, the reason why I know that, if you look at your sources, you won't find it anywhere. The reason why I know about this conversation, which has not been reported anywhere, is because Stuart Holland is a co-author of this modest proposal. And it's a nice bit of serendipity when you have somebody who was in the room relating this conversation. So, in a sense, Thatcher was right. Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl had this view that they were taking the first step towards federation. They understood that they had political constraints that did not allow them to take even the first step towards the creation of a common debt that would be a first step towards real political union. But they hoped that the crisis would bring about that which their own political arithmetic at that time was not in a position to furnish them with. So Thatcher's nightmare was possibly Mitterrand's and Kohl's dream. The big question, however, is, was Mitterrand right in trusting that his successors would respond to a major financial crisis by opting for federation rather than for fragmentation? It is now abundantly clear to me, having experienced this crisis up close and personal for the last 4 or 5 years, that this assumption was foolhardy. It was actually plainly wrong. Just look at the so-called banking union, which I mentioned before. If you put it under the microscope, actually, you don't even need the microscope, you just need a little bit of light to look at it very, very carefully. The unification of banking sectors across the Eurozone, which is absolutely essential, was proclaimed recently in theory to be denied in practice, to be confirmed in the breach rather than the observance. 6 years into this crisis that Mitterrand so presciently predicted, where are the rear door, back door federalists that Thatcher was so much afraid of? My answer is nowhere. And I shall try to defend that position in a second. Now, is there an explanation of what I think is a predictive failure on the part of both Mitterrand and Thatcher as to the effect of a crisis on possible federation? Well, I submit to you that there is. I want to share with you a quotation that goes back to 1971. It is a dangerous error to believe that monetary and economic union can precede a political union, or that it will act as a lever for the involvement of a political union, which in the long run it will in any case be unable to do without. For if the creation of a monetary union and community control over national budgets generates pressures which lead to a breakdown of the whole system, it will prevent the development of a political union, not promote it. The author of those lines was Nicholas Calder, professor of economics at the University of Cambridge, and this was an article published in the New Statesman in March of 1971. So we have a difference of opinion. Calder on the left versus Kohl, Thatcher, and Mitterrand on the right, who felt that the experiment with a common currency, with the European Monetary Union, was going to lead to federation. But let's take things from the beginning, shall we? From the very outset, the construction of the European community constituted an asymmetrical free trade zone. Germany, or Holland, possibly to some extent Finland, feature oligopolistic manufacturing sectors that produce high-end consumption as well as capital goods, with significant economies of scale and the capacity to deter entry as a result of these economies of scale and excess capacity. The periphery, for instance, countries like Portugal, South Italy, Greece, and so on, are populated by a myriad of tiny firms with low price-cost margins and an industry that has no capacity to generate substantial capital goods or excess capacity which is necessary to deter entry. So by definition, a country like Germany can simply not generate enough domestic demand to absorb all the products that its industry can produce. And that creates a chronic, systematic current account surplus within this asymmetrical free trade zone. Now, if the exchange rate were to be flexible as it was up until the 1990s, or flexible depending on the state of the European exchange rate mechanism, but that's another story, then the adjustments of the exchange rate mechanism will somehow ameliorate for this constant asymmetry, imbalance in terms of trade. Now, this constant devaluation of the Italian lira, of the Greek drachma, of the scudo, and so on, posed significant problems for the elites of both types of nations. Germany's industry was hampered by uncertainty regarding a number of things that were important to it, like, for instance, how many Deutschmarks would it receive on a BMW that it produced for sale to Greece, when they didn't know what the exchange rate would be in between, when Volkswagen was building gearboxes in Spain in order to be returned to Germany for the Volkswagen Golf to be assembled, the constant devaluation and the uncertainty that that involved meant that Volkswagen had difficulty predicting the cost of its Volkswagen Golf prior to pricing it, and so on and so forth. At the same time, the elites of the periphery, like in my own country, I know this from personal experience, loathed devaluation because it meant that their, you know, villas in the leafy suburbs of northern Athens would slide in value vis-a-vis equivalent mansions in Belgravia or Paris, which is why where they would like to spend their excess cash. Similarly, workers in Italy and in Greece loathed devaluation because it meant that, you know, the small pay rises they managed to exact from employers after lengthy strikes, disputes, negotiations, and so on were eaten up by a stroke of the Bank of Italy or the Central Bank of Greece's devaluation pen. This is why, despite the obvious pitfalls of the euro, nations are drawn to it like moths to the flame. Now, what does it take to stabilize an asymmetrical monetary union? Asymmetrical monetary unions, whenever and wherever tried in combination with free trade and free capital movements, have ended up in tears. The gold exchange standard in the mid-war period, various pegs between domestic currencies of Latin America, Mexico, Argentina, and so on, and the United States, the European exchange rate mechanism which preceded the euro, they all ended up in smithereens. They all resembled, as I like to say, invasions of Russia. A brisk beginning full of hope and enthusiasm, rapid progress that seemed unstoppable, followed by heart-wrenching slowdown as cruel winter took hold and we ended up with blood on the snow. The question is, why is this happening? The reason is not too difficult to discern. I shall use Germany and Greece as paradigmatic of surplus and deficit countries. Now, German trade surpluses cause capital to accumulate in German banks, pushing real interest rates down in countries like Germany. At the same time, countries like Greece are starved of capital. Real interest rates go up. German banks create a tsunami, a wall of money that goes to the periphery, seeking higher rates of return. And if you fix the exchange rate, and if there is a common belief that that exchange rate is going to be fixed. In other words, there is this illusion that the system is working and will carry on working. The wall of money becomes even bigger as the risk of devaluation subsides, at least in the mind of the bankers. Now, these capital flows, of course, inflate bubbles in the periphery because the periphery does not have the productive capacity to turn these investments into capital goods. And you have real estate prices going up in Ireland or in Spain or in Greece. You have the kleptocratic state that creates Olympic Games in 2004 and bubbles in the public sector and so on and so forth. And, of course, you know, the comeuppance of bubbles is that they burst. And when they burst, what they leave behind in the periphery is unpayable debts. And at some point, if the burden of adjustment falls on the deficit countries, then something was going to give. And what usually gives is the peg, or the fixed exchange rate. So Ponzi growth gives its place to what I call Ponzi austerity. And in the end, the experiment with a common currency, a fixed exchange rate, simply fails. The only thing that can help a currency union to survive is to have what I refer to as an extra market surplus recycling mechanism. In the United States, you know this as a federal budget or the military-industrial complex or the FDIC that constantly recycles surpluses from where they are produced to where they are not produced, stabilizing the union and ensuring that when a crisis happens, it doesn't end up with a domino effect contagion and the complete devastation of the dollar zone, also known as the United States of America. Now, none of this is new. It's a story, if you want, of the mid-war period, the story of the Great Depression, that Europe saw it fit to repeat that piece of sorry economic history in the 21st century is mind-boggling. What is most disturbing, however, is not that our leaders do not understand these simple facts of macroeconomics. What personally disturbs me is that their incomprehension leaves them completely and utterly unabashed and unashamed. To understand, however, this paralysis that we have been observing now in the last 5 years. Not only the paralysis, but the inanity of the way that we implanted the gold standard in Europe, pretending that we could avoid the horrors of the gold exchange standard's demise. We need to delve a little bit deeper into the history, what I call the DNA of the European Union. The European Union was just like the German Constitution, and indeed the Bundesbank, an American creation. I know that this is very un-European, as you would say here, un-American, un-European, right, to say. Because Europeans like to convince themselves that the European Union is a magnificent European design that we conjured up, and it's no such thing. It came about as the New Deal administration in the late 1940s designed the post-war global plan, part of which was, of course, Bretton Woods, but it was not the only part. Bretton Woods was to provide the common currency. It would allow America to dollarize Europe, to monetize Europe and dollarize it, by creating a fixed exchange rate regime, which would be capitalism-wide for the whole of the Western world, effectively a gold-backed dollar standard. But in addition to this, they did not just replicate the gold standard. There was a very clear understanding between White, let's say, and Keynes in Bretton Woods of a need for what I referred to before as the extra market surplus recycling mechanism. The difference between White and Keynes was that Keynes wanted this to be a multilateral UN-like institution. White said to him, listen, mate, it is our surpluses and we will recycle them any way we want, which is exactly what happened. The Marshall Plan was just one example of this kind of recycling. But there was a little bit more to this global plan that came out of the late 1940s. There was also the idea that the dollar zone had to be supported by at least two monetary pillars, two currencies that would act as shock absorbers in support of the dollar. And there was a very interesting theoretical background to this idea concerning monetary transmission mechanisms, but I shall not go into this now. And the two pillars that were selected, of course, were the Deutschmark and the yen. And the idea was, naturally, that powerful currencies require powerful surplus heavy goods industries in order to support them, and those industries require vital space and hinterland around them in order to create the demand that would be requisite so as to be able to maintain this output of capital goods and net exports. The vital space for German industry, of course, was the rest of Europe, and this is how the European common market emerged. For Japan, it's quite interesting. The original idea is that China should play that role, but of course, Mao Zedong had other ideas. And what is very interesting is how quickly the United States authorities opened their own backyard to Japan, providing that vital, American markets to Japanese industry as its own vital space. Now, the European component of this plan had to overcome a very significant difficulty. And the difficulty was the Allied agreement in 1946 that effectively Germany should be returned to a Neolithic age or to a pastoral set of circumstances. More than 750 industrial plants had been destroyed by late 1946, and that had to end. France was the major obstacle, and to cut a long story short, because I'm sure that most of you know this story, European unity was forged by American diplomacy. It was built upon an American plan, according to which a German-dominated cartel of heavy industry, which then became the Union of Coal and Steel, which would cut into this deal French farmers through subsidies coming from the rents enjoyed by that cartel, which would then be transferred on to French farmers. That's what became later the Common Agricultural Policy, and administered by the French in Brussels, so that the graduates of the Grand Ecole, as well as by French banks, which were far more advanced than German banks. This was a kind of social contract that became the foundation of the European Union, and as I say, it was an American design, just like the Bundesbank and the German Constitution. Now, this fledgling European economic community, from the moment it got started, produced large surpluses that fueled post-war prosperity, as we all know. In a stable world environment, where the Bretton Woods system was constantly stabilized by the United States through administrative steps as well as pure surplus recycling. Between 1950 and 1961, 70% of American surpluses can be shown to have been recycled to Asia, especially Japan, and to Western Europe. It was, in important ways, an American triumph. Alas, by the mid-1960s, it was all dead in the water. Why? Because America no longer had surpluses. And this system, which was predicated upon the recycling of American surpluses, could not survive anymore. Why didn't have surpluses? We are all familiar with the stories that involve Vietnam. It involved the loss of competitiveness of American industry to Japanese and German industry, partly because American multinationals were offshoring to Germany and to Japan, but not wholly. The Great Society program was also participating in the creation of those deficits. It was around that time that a great Texan, John Connolly, was appointed by President Nixon to be his Treasury Secretary. And I have a very interesting quotation, which I didn't know until a few weeks ago. The way that Connolly convinced Nixon to do away with the Bretton Woods system, to kill it off, was with this expression: "Mr. President, we must screw these foreigners before they screw us." You can imagine John Connolly saying that. Right? So we had the announcement on the 15th of August 1971, when effectively we had the announcement of the euthanasia of this global plan. It was a day the dollar was decoupled effectively from gold and later on from all the other currencies, especially the European ones. And when John Connolly toured Europe, he came up with the famous expression. He was less impolite this time to the Europeans. He said to them, "It is our currency, but it is your problem." Europe had suddenly become unhinged. That's the title of my book. Now, immediately, even before that happened, when the European leaders started getting a whiff that this was going to happen, they started trying to plan and to design their own version of Bretton Woods within Europe, a system of fixed exchange rates. Why? Because Germany, the moment Europe became unhinged and the Deutschmark started free-floating, faced a hugely rising Deutschmark, while at the same time, countries like France and a lot more so Italy pegged their currencies to the falling dollar. And that pushed another wedge in between, inside this European economic community. It made, to give you just a very brief example, it made it impossible to run the European common market policy when you had this divergence of currencies. This is why a fixed exchange rate regime was considered by European leaders, primarily Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the new president of France, and Helmut Schmidt, the Chancellor of Germany, who signed that accord in 1978, the EMS, the European Monetary System, that set the train going on its rails. Now, didn't European leaders know that if you don't equip a fixed exchange rate system with a surplus recycling mechanism, you are asking for trouble? I believe that at least those leaders back then understood it. For instance, the conversation that Mitterrand had with Delors demonstrates that at least some of them did know. They didn't speak those words in public, but they certainly knew. Now, I believe that there were two reasons why they did not introduce this extra market surplus recycling mechanism into the workings of the European monetary system and the European Union. The first one is, as the 1940s demonstrate vividly, that you need a hegemon to design and to implement such a mechanism. Neither Germany nor France had the power to do this in the European context. But most importantly, the need for an intra-European, extra-market, surplus recycling mechanism subsided by the early 1980s. Why? Because of the new role the United States economy began to play after Paul Volcker destabilized the international economy through the major interest rates hikes. Let me refer to Volcker twice in two different quotations, which I think are so pivotal in understanding this process. The first one was when he was heading President Nixon's task force in 1970. His remit, his brief, was to answer the question that Nixon put to him: what are we going to do with this Bretton Woods system that is failing? And his answer in a memo that he submitted to Henry Kissinger, while Kissinger was still the National Security Advisor, read very beautifully, so elegantly. He said, if we can't recycle our surpluses because we don't have any, perhaps we should recycle other people's surpluses. This is one quotation, 1970. 1978, 2 weeks after he becomes chairman of the Fed, he's giving a talk at the University of Warwick. And in it, I don't have the quotation, I should have the quotation in front of me, but I just remembered it and I'll just paraphrase it. You will excuse me for that, but I can give you the precise words. He said that faced with a choice between a stable international economy and a set of circumstances that are functional to the interests of the United States, we opted for the latter. And then he continued, saying that a controlled disintegration of the global economy seems to me the appropriate aim for the 1980s. The first quotation, I think, tells the story. What would Germany do if faced with a major twin deficit problem? They would tighten their belts. This is precisely what the United States did not do under Connolly, under Volcker, under Nixon, and later on. Instead, I believe that it was a considered choice, policy choice, to expand these deficits. Who would pay for these deficits? The rest of the world. How? By means of a permanent transfer of capital that would rush ceaselessly across the two great oceans from Asia, Japan initially, and then China, and from Europe, across the Atlantic, attracted to Wall Street by the prospect of higher returns. So the deficits, the twin deficits of the United States economy, operated for quite a few decades like a giant vacuum cleaner, absorbing other people's net exports and surplus capital, closing this recycling loop. And then when China came into the loop, of course, this system took off almost exponentially. Almost 70% of European, Japanese, and Chinese surpluses in the period between 1990 and 2006 were transferred back to Wall Street in the form of capital inflows. It financed not only the United States government and the trade deficit, but also the rise of financialization. What do bankers in Wall Street do if you give them about $3 to $4 billion dollars daily net to play with, even if you give it to them for 10 minutes? They find ways of making it grow for themselves. Now, this is the reason why Europe, despite having introduced an unsustainable gold standard-like fixed exchange rate regime in its midst from the late 70s all the way up until the creation of the euro, seemed to be prospering. The necessary surplus recycling was made possible by this tsunami of capital and recycling that the United States economy was providing to the rest of the world as a service, in a sense, creating the requisite demand for the net exporters like Germany, like Japan, later China, and at the same time mopping up their surplus capital and providing them with returns that now they don't have, by the way. Now, Europeans, who are like a little bit like the Bourbons, who remember everything and learn nothing, thought that they could leave surplus recycling to the United States economy, erecting their own euro, their own gold standard within our eurozone, assuming that this was a permanent state of affairs. Now, the rest, as they say, is history. Because when Lehman Brothers went under, the first thing that happened in Europe was we discovered that our banks were replete with this toxic waste, that our leverage ratios were almost twice that of Lehman Brothers. Deutsche Bank had twice the leverage rate of Lehman Brothers. And the worst part of it was, that the Eurozone, as an architecture, was simply incapable of sustaining such shock waves. To put it very bluntly, imagine what would have happened in the United States if the state of Nevada had to bail out the banks of Nevada and pay for the increased unemployment benefits due to the collapse of the real estate sector and to the construction sector in Nevada, and had to do this without the help of the Fed and without the federal government, and had to go to the international money markets and borrow independently. I can assure you that the state of Nevada would become a basket case, just like Greece became, and then contagion would spread throughout the dollar zone. This was the eurozone architecture that we had created, which was absolutely perfectly incapable of dealing with these shock waves. Now, many Europeans deep down, hoped that Mrs. Thatcher was right, that monetary union was an underhanded move towards federation, and when this major crisis would happen, we would respond by completing the union, by creating a federal treasury, for instance, that would provide a modicum of surplus recycling within the Eurozone. Instead, if my prognosis is right, we seem to be going for fragmentation rather than federation. Why is that the case? On the 1st of September this year, a very interesting article was published in the Financial Times. It was co-authored by Schäuble and Lammers. Schäuble, of course, Wolfgang Schäuble, is the finance minister of Germany. And in it, he made a proposal. He proposed that Europe should become a political union. Mind you, this is not the first time that Mr. Schäuble has proposed that. He proposed it the first time around in 1995, which is quite interesting. And he proposed a European budget commissioner with powers to reject national budgets if they do not correspond to the rules we jointly agreed. This sounds like a political union. He also proposed the creation of a chamber within the European Parliament that would only comprise members from the Eurozone states. Now, let me begin with this proposal for what I call a fiscal leviathan, with the power to strike down national budgets. In 1995, in that article that I mentioned, the earlier article by Mr. Schäuble, he took a swipe at the notion of national sovereignty, and he called it a nonsensical notion, pouring scorn on the academic debate over whether Europe is a federation or an alliance of states. Now, if Dr. Schäuble was right then, that there is no noteworthy difference between a federation and an alliance of states, then his idea of establishing a fiscal leviathan can be seen as a federal move, a move towards a federal direction. I submit to you that the two are very different beasts, an alliance of states from a federation. Despite its numerous faults and toxic politics, the American Constitution evolved through an unabashedly political process, a process of conflict between vested interests at the federal level, at the state level, between capitalists and labor unions. The United States has been a political process from its inception. In contrast, as I argued a bit before, the European Union's bureaucracy was built from the outset as a democracy, even a politics-free zone. One that the New Dealers that rebuilt Europe simply tolerated in order to get the Franco-German axis to function. In this sense, from the beginning, from its inception, the European Common Market was an attempt at depoliticizing the process of European integration, subjecting it to the guidance and administration of unelected technocrats who would consistently reduce politics to management and democracy to consultation. One of the forgotten facts about liberal democracies, at least forgotten in Europe, is that the Constitution's legitimacy is determined not by its legal content, but by politics. Political authority is the cement that keeps legislation together, and this sovereignty of the body politic is what engenders this legislation as its foundation. To claim, as Mr. Schäuble did in 1995 and continues to claim today, that it makes no difference whether the Eurozone is an alliance of sovereign states or a federal state is purposely to ignore that nation states can create political authority, whereas an alliance of nation states cannot. An alliance of states can, of course, come to mutually beneficial defense arrangements like NATO, or agreeing to common industry standards, or to bringing about a free trade zone like NAFTA. But such an alliance of sovereign states can never legitimately create an overlord with the right to strike down the state sovereignty, since there is no collective alliance-wide sovereignty from which to draw the necessary political authority to do so. This is why the difference between a federation and an alliance of states is substantial and matters hugely. And this is something in Europe that we are incapable even of discussing. For while a federation replaces the sovereignty forfeited at the national or the state level with a newfangled sovereignty at the federal level, centralizing power within something like the Eurozone today, within an alliance of states, is by definition legitimate and lacks any sovereign body with the people, doesn't exist, to lend it political legitimacy. Now, one may retort that, hang on a second, the European Union is a fully democratic set of institutions. Its democratic credentials are not to be disputed. Everybody gets elected to be on the EU Council. The members of the Commission are appointed by elected governments, and so on and so forth. And there's also the European Parliament with some power to throw out parts of legislation. It is also often added, and this is, I think, a highly worrying addition, addendum to this argument, that sovereignty is highly overrated these days in the era of globalization. I mean, what sovereignty can little Iceland or little Greece have? Now, this retort, to me, demonstrates the extent to which Western European appreciation of the founding principles of liberal democracy have been depleted. Now, while members of the European Council are elected, let me take it from the beginning. The members of the European Council are elected officials answerable theoretically to their own parliaments. But you know what? Every time they breach a decision, they go back home. Invariably, they claim that they were not in favor of it. All of them. Nobody was in favor. So as a body, they're not answerable to any parliament. And moreover, by the time they get home, the legislation that they push through at the European Council level takes precedence over national legislation. As for the claim that small countries on their own don't have any reason to have sovereignty because they are powerless anyway, to claim that Iceland's sovereignty is obsolete because it is too small to have much power is like arguing that a weak person with next to no political clout might as well give up her political rights. To put it slightly different, small sovereign nations like Iceland or like Greece have choices to make within the broader constraints that nature and the rest of the world impose upon them. However limited this room for maneuver, for choice, Iceland's body politic retains absolute authority to hold their elected officials accountable for the decisions that they have reached within the nation's exogenous constraints. Nothing like this exists in Europe at the level of the Eurozone. Funnily enough, we've ended up in a situation where the Eurozone is a mighty macroeconomy. I mean, it is the largest economy in the world, with a powerful central bank, which is utterly powerless to do that which it judges to be essential to do, with no government at the Eurozone level, and no body politic, no equivalent to we the people to legitimize what we're doing. Now, according to this reading that I would like to discuss with you, Mrs. Thatcher's error was to mistake the Central European traditionalist, corporatist, and highly conservative notion of a Europe of nations, of an alliance of nations, for a penchant for a federal Europe. I submit to you that there was never any political project by anyone, Jean Monnet included, Robert Schuman included, to create a federal Europe, to create a federal democratically elected government. The idea was always to erect a mighty bureaucracy that would work together with and on behalf of national governments, constantly tuned into the interests of a large Central European cartel based on profound norms of anti-competitive behavior in a manner that makes democratic accountability not difficult, but impossible. Seen from this perspective, the Europe of Nations, consistent with and functional to the dominance of the capital goods sector, that was the foundation of the European Union, tolerated by the United States. Within this context, the notion of a federal republic where the sans-culottes of France, of Greece, of Portugal would participate in electing a federal government on a one-person, one-vote basis was always anathema to European leaders from 1950 to this very day. And it has never been uttered as a possible political direction in which we could follow. It simply did not and does not compute. So, this is my sort of conclusion. The European Union's radical reluctance to move in the direction of a federation and instead to go for it towards a political union which is profoundly anti-democratic and therefore not federalist. It's not a mystery after all. No cartel that controls the administration of its vital space directly wants to concede that exorbitant privilege to some democratically elected government, central government, federal government, especially when a huge, expensive bureaucracy has been set up in Brussels precisely to preclude this. a bureaucracy that includes some very skilled technocrats who harbor a deep platonic contempt for democracy and for history. Well-meaning Europeanists, along with Mitterrand and Kohl, once dreamt of that which Mrs. Thatcher feared. A federal Europe that would result from a spasm like the one we're going through today. I believe that, unfortunately, these well-meaning Europeanists are failing to understand that it is not a simple matter to graft a federal democracy upon a Brussels-based technocracy representing the holy alliance between run-of-the-mill apparatchiks, technocrats, representing a heavy goods industry that has become ossified in the last 30, 40 years. If you look at the companies that top the top 500 list 30 years ago in Europe, they are more or less the same as they were today. Compare and contrast with the United States. Functional to that ossification, of course, was this Brussels technocracy and national politicians in national state governments who have their own exceptionally cozy relationship with local bankrupt bankers, seen over and functioning under the aegis of larger European transnational banks who loathe the idea of a powerful European regulator. We need to grasp what a Herculean task it would be to inject genuine representative democracy at a federal level in Europe into the institutional melange representing this unholy alliance, which has evolved into a European Union atavistically inimical both to democracy and to the form of extra market surplus recycling, which is necessary to stabilize an economy like that of the Eurozone and a monetary union like that of the Euro. This is why I believe we are witnessing such almighty resistance to the idea of shared debts, of a real banking union, of common unemployment and social security throughout Europe, and a real parliament for the union that might have, unlike the European Union, the opportunity, the right to initiate legislation. Did you know the European Parliament doesn't have that right to initiate legislation? And we have the audacity to call it a parliament. So, if anything, the euro crisis has made this titanic task even harder by setting one proud nation against another, as we see happening in Europe today. In this never-ending crisis, and faced with a stark choice between fragmentation and federation, it is not a great surprise, however heartbreaking it might be, to many of us Europeans, that our European leaders are allowing themselves to sleepwalk towards fragmentation. Thank you.